Welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Judy Herman, and today I'm absolutely thrilled, actually, to be with Les Brotherston, deep in the heart of West Sussex, here to talk about, really, the relationship between, I think, between designer and director. But she's very close for you, Les, whether or not it's Matthew. I mean, I think you must be close to every director you work with.
Yeah, that's the hope. That's the aim. I mean, the aim is that when somebody comes along and asks you to do a piece, they don't come and say, and this is how I want to do it. They're kind of embarking on a journey where they say, I'd like to do this piece, I'd like to do it with you, now let's talk about it. And then together you figure out a way in which you can do the piece and come up with a theatrical presentation of it.
And so you always would be in right from the beginning, once the before the concept.
Before the concept is what you hope for, and it's what designers do. It's very odd. I think the public's perception is that a director comes along and tells you what to do. And no director has ever told me what to do. Or actually, that's not quite true. When they have, it's not been a happy collaboration because I'm being forced into doing something that I don't necessarily think is my approach to the piece. But those early talks about when you sit down and you either read the play or you listen to the opera or you... In terms of dance, whether it was with Christopher Gable or with Matthew Bourne, we would sit down and just start with a story and together decide how to tell that story in terms of dance and physical theatre.
And sometimes does the lighting designer come in at this stage?
Not quite that early. Usually when there's something to react to. It's funny, with for instance, with Matthew, he's very much an editor and a director rather than a choreographer. And I'm not being rude. It's just, you know, what he does is he collaborates. And so what, in particularly on something on the Red Shoes, I said, I've had an idea for how to do it. Shall I model something up and show you? And then I modeled up the arch, the proscenium arch, and how it worked and said, this is a concept. I don't know how each scene works yet, but this is a basic concept. How do you feel about it? And he went, yes. And then it allows you to design the individual bits of the story. He comes up with a kind of narrative, a kind of way of storyline, and I respond to that. And I provide him with visual stimulus, models and drawings and reference, and we build the story together.
It seems to me incredibly important that you pretty well always do both the costumes and the set. Is that right?
It's a very British thing, and I really like... doing it. It's my training as well. My training at Central School was that, you know, you are a visual director. You sit there and you make the world and you inhabit the world with those people. In America, it's slightly different. They kind of do separate it out, and I don't really enjoy it. I've done it maybe two or three times, and with the exception of one, I haven't really felt that the production's mine. It's sort of, if you're doing costumes, you're kind of servicing someone else's concept, and if you're doing set, you don't feel like you're in touch with the actors because you never really meet them. You're always in an auditorium looking at set and lighting, and you're never talking to an actor about a characterization or a character.
So how soon after the set for you do you start thinking about the costumes? Is it at the same time overall?
Well, sometimes it's before. Sometimes it's easier to sit and draw costumes and to think about characters and to come up with references and to look at the people. Like, for instance, at the moment I'm working on Fiddler on the Roof, and I've designed all the costumes, and there's only a few bits of set. I know where we're going with the set, but I want to get the characters right first, and then I know the world to put them in.
They've just announced their season.
I mean, I'm doing two at Chichester this year. I'm doing 40 Years On and Fiddler on the Roof. 40 Years On is designed. It's in the workshops, well before they announced. And we've been working on Fiddler for a couple of weeks now.
Who's directing that?
Daniel Evans will be directing both of them. And it's his first season at Chichester. And I was really flattered because he was the artistic director of Sheffield. And I went up to Sheffield to do a piece not with him, but when I was there, he asked me to do Showboat for him, and he asked me to do a beautiful musical, which I loved, called Flowers to Mrs. Harris, which only was only ever going to be on for 2.5 weeks, and I hope we're going to revive it. And while I was there, he got the job at Chichester, and he said, would I be part of the first season? So I'm really thrilled to be doing both of his in the main house.
We've already mentioned a musical. We've mentioned a lot of dance. I'm now going to mention The Rover, which is a reimagining at carnival time in the West Indies, really, isn't it, of Afra Behn's wonderful girls on top comedy, I'm calling it, because watching it the other day, that's what I thought. At least the girls were leading the narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Afra Behn, it was the first woman playwright, really, on the stage in Restoration Britain. It is, you know, probably the first woman writer who's actually got, you know, the scale of those plays on stage. And it was done rather famously when it first opened the Swan Theatre, and when the Swan Theatre first opened. And this was a kind of, because it's 30 years since the Swan opened, we were part of the revival season where they did the same programme. They did Two Noble Kinsmen and The Rover running together.
I'm smiling because I've realised I must have seen, and I did see it. I wanted to cover The Rover just because I'd loved it so much the first time. And this is so different. This was another example, I think, of the costumes and the set working so well together, and you were having to think of what the people were going to do in the costumes, I think. I mean, in dance, that's a given, well, it is with it. But there's sword fighting, there's a lot of swashbuckling in that, and the girls have to change into man's attire. The most luscious thing I've ever seen is Faye Costello in red breeches, I think, and a gypsy shirt. It was just gorgeous. So presumably you have some ideas, but you're modelling those things on the people who are going to wear them.
Yeah, I mean, when I first designed The Rover, it wasn't cast. And so I literally just had to respond to the text and work with the director and say, this is the kind of world I think we're in. And then once it was cast, I could look at the people that were cast and say, adapt or not adapt, say, this will be fine on you, but with you, I think we ought to think about something else or just adapting what we have there. So you work with the people that you're given. Occasionally, if you're really lucky, you sometimes get involved in the casting as well. Then you can go, this is a big man, I think, or this is a small woman, or this is a huge woman, or it's a voluptuous woman or something. So, you know, please don't give me a twig to dress, because that's really hard. Let's work on the character.
Well, that's, you know, fantastic if you're actually involved in the casting. But you got Joseph Milson and you got, well, they were a wonderful cast all together, and Faye Costello, and that was... they must have been fun to design for. I mean, she's got the most incredibly svelte figure, and she's very pert and wonderful. So, to me, it looked like you got her to a T. Once she was in men's attire, she was so much happier.
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole point of The Rover. The Rover, when we first see them, the three sisters are in kind of big dresses, big, constrictive dresses that kind of make them behave in a very ladylike fashion. Of course, what they want to do is to go out and have a great time at the carnival and be like the men. The men are all out there whoring and womanizing and doing something. And the women are going, why can't we? Why, you know, even our servant, can't she come out and play as well? And indeed, to free themselves up, to do that, they disguise themselves as gypsies and they go out and they have just as raucous a time as the men. And that's a joy to watch. It's great fun to watch. And you're right, you know, I've known Joe Milson for quite a long time. I think I did his first job when he did Nicholas Nickleby at Greenwich or something, and he was Steerforth. And so I'd known him for a very long time, which is great because it means there's a vocabulary. I can go and say, right, Joe, what are we going to do? Are we going to do long hair? Are we going to do short hair? What can we do? Where can we push it? And that's the joy. I mean, and Alex as well, who played the courtesan.
Yeah, Alexandra Gilbraith, that is. Yes, it's a wonderful part.
They're together. They've known each other really, really a long time, those two actors as well. And the joy of watching them play with each other on stage was great fun, to the point where, you know, they did Corpse. They found each other hysterically funny. But they're grown up enough to know when they're allowed to do that and when it's fun to do that and when an audience will accept that and when they have to pull back from that. And the joy of watching those two crafts actors was great fun. I saw it on the last night and it was a riot. It was really good fun.
What I loved about the costumes for The Rover was that they were hybrid as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, so sometimes the top half could be the sort of flowing Elizabethan sort of garb, and then the bottom half would be, well, denim. I've never seen that before, but it was hugely successful there. So that's to do with, you've shifted the period, obviously, if you've shifted to the West Indies during Carnival, but you still wanted to keep that Restoration feel, I think.
Yeah, it was trying to make a period piece a little bit more relevant for a modern audience. And so, you know, if you smother something in completely authentic costumes, for me, I'm afraid, a bit like when the Globe did, you know, Original Practice, you kind of go, my heart sinks because it's lovely watching a bit of a historical reenactment, but come on, let me in. Find a way to let me in to care about these people. And I found that with the Rover, what I really wanted to do was, rather than it become just a great big costume piece of heavy period costumes, was to allow people to move, and putting them in jeans and stuff was great, and then mixing kind of buff coats and keeping the cut quite period, but then taking the sleeves out and putting denim sleeves into it and stuff. So it felt like it could be a jacket that could be worn rather than a costume that you paraded in. And so it was just an attempt to try and make them feel a little bit more modern, but keep a taster of period so that you remembered this wasn't now.
I would say it's spectacularly successful. So with that, there was this very interesting, quite ornate set that did, I think, evoke the West Indies for me. There was some wrought iron and balconism. That, again, I mean, you must have been thinking about that all the time, how they would move on it.
Yeah, in the Swan, of course. And the Swan comes with, you know, a relatively difficult brief in that you're only allowed something like an hour for a turnaround. So that means I have to take one set out and put the next set in an hour. So they've made some improvements in this one. When I first worked in this one years ago, you had to bring everything up through the floor through a 1 meter trap. So they've made that a bit easier. So and the Swan really does define what you can do. It's a very kind of overlong thrust, so it's quite hard to play the thrust because your instinct as an actor is to play out front. But actually, most of your audience are watching from the sides because it's such a very, very deep thrust, which means that anything you put on that thrust is in the way of somebody seeing something. So you do end up pushing things back or trying to take things up in the air to free up the space and allow people to use the space. And so with the Rover, I knew it was going to be a romp and I knew there were going to be people climbing and jumping down. And so we just had to get access down from balconies and stuff. So in a funny way, it sort of designed itself. I wanted to put a bridge in there so that you could get people high up and not at the side, because those balconies in the Swan are great acting positions, but not all the time. And you want to get people high up, but in the middle. And so I bridged across the two and put the spiral staircase. I think it was the director who very much wanted a spiral staircase. I had a different one to begin with. And just finding a way to try and change the building. I wish I could have gone further. I love in the Swan. I've done a few. I did The Empress and Much Ado with Tamsin Gregg in there. And I love the Swan allows itself to make it feel like event theatre, that you can, if with the Empress, we weren't in rep with anything, so we could take over the space and hang lamps and hang things, and coming into the space when it's been invaded by a production is quite exciting. Slight with the Rover, I would have liked to have gone a bit further, but the turnaround time didn't allow it, really.
Yes, that's Loveday Ingram, the director, who liked the idea of a spiral staircase. Yeah. I love that idea that she has on her wish list a spiral staircase, and you made it happen for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was. I had some other stairs, and she just thought that she could get quicker access for because it was about the speed of how people get down there with a spiral rather than having to dogleg round.
Yeah, just all these things you have to think of. Now, something completely different. At least you were designing... it wasn't even going to transfer to London, so you didn't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. If we move back to dance, and we do take the Red Shoes as the thing that's touring at the moment, it's having to fit into an awful lot of different spaces. Mm-hmm. So presumably you have to take that on board when you're designing.
We do. With the Red Shoes, actually, with all of Matt's shows, with the new adventure shows that we got in the rep now, we kind of, when we began, we used to make it flexible so we could go bigger or smaller. But actually, that led to quite a lot of problems in that it meant that every Tuesday when the cast get there, there had to be a massive re-rehearsal for respacing because the space had changed. What we tried to do now is come up with a floor print that stays the same in every venue, even though that might mean the proscenium arch is wider or narrower. But actually, where the things are tend to stay the same, which means that the dancers can do a very quick walk-through, run-through on a Tuesday afternoon before they do the first show on a Tuesday.
You see, these practical considerations, I mean, so you've got the two things all the time, the vision and the collaboration, but then there's always the practicalities. I mean, with dance, the massive practicalities of being able to dance in the costumes you design.
Yeah, it's quite funny because when the first person who ever asked me to do dance was Christopher Gable, and he asked me to do Romeo and Juliet for him at Northern Ballet Theatre, and I remember saying to him, oh, I don't know if I'm the right designer for you because I've never done a tutu. And he thought that was hysterical and went, no, there are no tutus in Romeo and Juliet. I went, okay, fine, okay. And then we started talking about the play, which, you know, was an eye-opener for me because Christopher was very text-based and very, very kind of the dance came from the acting rather than the steps leading to the acting. You know, you had to find out who the character was, how they felt, and that would make the steps happen, which I understood and I got.
The costume, the set as well, it's dictated by what the dancers have got to do.
It's true, but I soon found out that, you know, I thought there was a great mystery about how you built dance costumes, and there isn't. There's about two or three technical tricks you can do with a three-part sleeve, with just stuff. And actually, I worked with quite a lot of experienced makers who taught me. I went and said, this is what I'd like to do, this, and they kind of explained to me why a sleeve should be constructed in a certain way, so that when you raise your arm, the whole body doesn't raise up. And, you know, it's kind of common sense. That's sort of the easy bit, because even if you don't know how to do it, the makers you're using will know how to do it as well, and they'll make adjustments as they go along.
Yes, so there's always, behind you, there is this army of makers, makers?
There are lots and lots of makers, and I do a drawing, I give them the reference, I choose the fabrics, but I do it in consultation with them. There's a maker called Phil Reynolds, who makes a lot of stuff for me, and, like, for instance, he made the swan legs that we use in Swan Lake, and so I drew what I wanted, we bought some fabrics, we made a prototype, we looked at it, and that had to be done for a photograph. And then we looked at it, and we changed it. And over the years we've done Swan Lake, he's always done the swan legs, and has, you know, slightly evolved how they're made so that they're a little bit easier or a little bit... But I mean, it was, again, it's very much a collaboration which I just head up. I just kind of steer it. And, you know, there's no point in going to brilliant makers like Phil and Sasha and Jane Johnson and all those people that I've used for years if you don't listen to what they say. And they kind of say, we see what you want, but you need to do it like this. And they train me.
I like that. I like the but. It's an important but. Mm-hmm. It could have been and, but it's but is mm-hmm. the right one here. So just very briefly before we go back then to the red shoes. So that with your idea, the swan's legs that we all remember, that we instantly have that picture, the way of making them male, very male.
No, I think that's the fact that Matt came... Well, I'll tell you the whole story. The whole story was... I was doing Highland Fling, and at that time the next show was Swan Lake, and I wasn't designing Swan Lake. Another designer was going to design Swan Lake, and at a little way into it, they pulled out. And then I'd just done Swan Lake for Christopher Gable at Northern Ballet Theatre, and Matt had seen it, and it wasn't really his cup of tea. And so he kind of thought that me doing another Swan Lake after I've just done a Swan Lake was probably not a great idea. And he kind of fished around for other designers. But finally, he kind of came back and said, well, could we do a Swan Lake and would it be different? And I said, and I was absolutely game and up for it. And he came with the idea that he wanted the swans to be danced by men. That was the only kind of directorial guide I got. And so when I started working on it, we spoke about it quite a lot. And I said, why do you want swans to be men? And the whole point was that he wanted them to be physically more aggressive. And I was saying, well, in which case, we don't want to cover their bodies up. We want to see as much of the body as possible. If they're animalistic and if they want to be aggressive, we certainly want to see their upper torso. And then, you know, and from that, it said it's going to be some kind of shorts. And then we talked about what kind of shorts it could be. And Matt found a picture of, it was an Indian dancer who had lots of string on his legs. And he said, this looks like it could move quite well. And I was like, well, okay, but we could do it in a different way. And then I came up with the silk chiffon idea about cutting it into stuff, sewing it on and grading it and shaping the legs. And we did it over a series of times. So it was very much a collaboration. It would be very hard for me to say, I didn't decide they were going to be men, but having made that decision that they were going to be men, it was about what I could show and what we were trying to achieve with it.
Yes, so now we've all, anyone who knows it at all, and that's an awful lot of millions of people, the moment you say it, we have a picture in our mind, we think feathers, although it's not, but it gives that impression. Yeah. And so that brings me strangely back to the red shoes, something you said earlier. You said something about, don't worry, it's not going to be tutus. What I love about the red shoes, my first impression when I was watching it was the fun that you'd had recreating how dance was when I remember being taken as a little girl. Well, I loved it, but it was all the man, it was Michael Soames supporting Fontaine, and that was his job, really, and it was all about the girls. And there was a particular way of walking. But yes, I would say it was all about tunics, tights, and tulle, I think I would say. Presumably you knew that world really well, but did you have a lot of fun going back to it?
It was good fun, and it was one of those decisions. When, again, when we first started talking about Red Shoes, there was, you know, the first discussion was, when is it set? When do we do it? We're not trying to recreate the film. We're trying to tell the same story, but how do we do it? And we did talk about it, and there was a, do we update it? Do we not update it? Do we leave? And that kind of ballet company only really exists in that time, and it seems perverse to move it out of the late 40s. I mean, the backstory is that Paul and Pressburger wrote the film, or intended to do a film about Nijinsky and Diaghilev, which is much earlier, it's, you know, 1914, 1915, but they didn't feel they could tell the story of a gay relationship at that time in film. And then with the resurgence of, or not the resurgence, but the start of British ballet, they just shifted all those characters. And so Lamentov is Diaghilev and Nijinsky is Vicky. And to a certain extent, Romola is the composer. And so the characters all have parallels to a story it was based on.
Well, I'm glad you told me that, because I don't think I would have spotted that. Mm-hmm. So the new story that they created actually goes back also to the Hans Christian. The whole point is that it's a very cruel, dark story, as so many of his are. I mean, there are an awful lot of girls, and there's a Little Mermaid dancing on knives. So there's that streak of cruelty running through it, but there's the art life thing. I mean, that's what it's about, isn't it? Yeah. And I was watching the film last night. You have changed the story, haven't you? And there's lots of delightful differences. Like at the beginning, our heroine does get to dance. Vicky Page actually does get to dance for Lermontov. And why not? Because you're doing dance. There's wonderful little twists and turns in the story, which I presume you were in on.
Yeah, I think the problem is that because it is dance, we don't have words. Mm. So, you know, you can dance emotion, you can dance happy, sad, torment, you can dance easy, but what you can't dance is, my mother's just gone to the shops. That's really, you know, you can't, that's impossible. Mm. So actually, at that point in Red Shoes, it's important to see Vicky's love of dance, and it's important to see Lamento's rejection of Vicky. That's the story. And that's what happens in words in the film. We have to do that in dance steps. And so she needs to dance in our version in order for us to see him ignore her. Whereas if she didn't dance and he ignored her, you've got no, there's no protagonist. There's nothing there to make it happen.
Yes, but that's what I'm saying, along the way, there's all these lovely little differences. So let's just go back to the actual set, and we can talk about the costumes on it as well. I love Meyerhold's idea of a machine for acting. But obviously, what you're doing is very much more, but it does still have to be a machine for dancing, I think. But obviously, the big thing on this one is this wonderful swivel set that you came up with that is art and life, because it's the red plush curtains that we see if we're in the audience, and then it swivels around and there's an imaginary audience the other side, and we see life backstage, and you use it in lots of different ways. So that was the first central concept that you had?
Yes, it was. It was strange. A few years ago, I was approached about doing another piece about theatre, which involved backstage and front of house and the shifting between the two of it. And it was an idea I came up with that. And that job, in the end, never happened. But when I was looking at Red Shoes again, I was thinking, I think that could work. I think it's a good idea of taking us backstage, front of house, framing a ballet, turning around. So what I did was I made a model, a 1:25 model of it, to show Matt, because it's hard to, you know, it's hard to understand when you go, it's a proscenium arch that doesn't touch the floor. It can move left and right, it can move up and down, and it can revolve. And without having something concrete in front of you, that's very hard to kind of get the concept of it. And indeed, in making the model, I kind of solved some of the engineering problems of how to make it work, so that literally, when we met the engineers, I could go, it's a bridge, it's supported like this, it then has a carriage that runs left and right in the bridge, and it has a revolve in it as well, so that they had to figure out how to do it, which is no mean feat, but they didn't have to, I didn't just give them the brief of make it move there, and there. We'd built the bridge that supports it in the model.
So the whole model worked, you mean?
The whole model, it wasn't electrified, but you could move it to where you needed to be. And indeed, then Matt and I could sit in front of the model and say, how about the proscenium here for this scene on there? And then when we rehearsed on set, which was great, it was one of those things that we knew we had to have the proscenium in rehearsals, otherwise we'd never find how to use it in the 1 week tech that you have in our schedules. And so we had it for, I think, about 5 or 6 weeks in the rehearsal room, so we could, with the automation people, program the movement of it and see. And indeed, the last sequence was inspired by The Automation Man. We said, show us something, show us a continuous movement of the arch with it spinning, with it going back, with it going, and he programmed something in, and pretty much we choreographed around what he made the arch do.
It's really successful, and what something very interesting comes out of that, I'm not quite sure how you say it, it's art imitating life, I suppose, but you brilliantly, you have to design the set of the red shoes, the set that's being designed by the designer in the story. And I love the fact that there was a model on the stage, which they kept referring to, it was on the piano, I think. Yeah. And I was very excited by that. You know, it's like a sort of meta comment, isn't it? It's very, very, very clever that there is the set. And then we see the whole, we actually see it, and it's incredibly different from anything in the film, actually.
I mean, the point of that ballet is in this 1948 company, which is doing Sylphide, and it's probably doing the same repertory as the Ballet Russe. It's doing all those old classics. That there is a new modern piece. There is a new piece that they've got a new composer who's exciting and vibrant. They've got a new dancer, and so it was important that the Red Shoes Ballet felt different to the world. And so that's why we went into having been in a kind of grey brick backstage world or red and gilt world, that suddenly we go into a very clinical, clean white space. All the costumes are black. The only colour in it is the red shoes. And we decided to use projections because that, again, it made it feel like a little modern ballet for this troupe to have produced. And it was a different vocabulary from anything else they got, which is why, in the story, the red shoes is so successful. It's a very clean space, and it gets very kind of graphic. So you get, you get a very white space with what was the shoemaker, we call him the pimp, kind of comes in a black suit with red stripes and a red tie, and it dangles the red shoes. And so it does become a kind of graphic storytelling. You have to kind of always bear in mind that at that point, you're an audience watching a ballet within a ballet, so that those characters can't look as real as the characters we've created for the rest of the piece. They do have to look like characters that might be in a ballet. So it gives you another kind of facet to the costume design.
Yes, another layer to the story. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. But then you have so much fun with the fact that they all go to the south of France, and you get to do the bathing costumes, and you get to do the beach balls. And now this is you lot. I know that there's a sequence in the film where Lermontov goes off to watch Vicky doing Swan Lake somewhere up east or wherever in the East End.
That's actually in Marie Rombert's theatre, and Marie Rombert's in that scene. Mm. I don't know if she's lady who does the record, but she's certainly there watching the lady who does the record. Mm. And it's I can't remember, is it the Embassy Theatre? I can't remember, it's the theatre that Ballet Rombert started at in West London.
Yeah, exactly. So it's in this little theatre. But what you do is that you have a sort of whole new bit of the story where the couple have now come clean. Julian Cresta, who's the big new hot composer, who obviously falls in love with the beautiful Vicky Page, much to the disgust of Lermontov. I mean, that is the love triangle. It's a life-art love triangle, really, isn't it? But there's a moment where they're sort of banished to the East End, and it just gives you this brilliant opportunity to bring in music halls. So we get Wilson and Keppel doing the sand dance watch all the neighbours cry. Where does that come from? And whose idea was that?
Well, I don't know whose idea it was. It came, I mean, it must be Matt's idea that he wanted to go to. What he wanted to do was to illustrate to us that Vicky, who was the star of the Ballet Lermontov, who was performing at Monte Carlo, who leaves Ballet Lermontov because Lermontov gets jealous and banishes Julian, that suddenly their fortunes are very different, and that the way she's now living is she's performing in something much less, and it's a music hall in the East End, and she's part of an adagio act, a kind of an act which is there for titillation rather than an act that's there for art. So she's the girl who's being flung around by men and supported by men and winding herself around men, and she doesn't like it, she feels it's beneath her. Julian's slightly oblivious because they're just trying to scratch together a living. And then what happens is she thinks she sees Lermontov watching her, and it prompts her to question her decision about leaving the ballet.
Well, I think people who don't know the story should be left to be shocked or whatever it is by the end of the story by themselves. And the only other thing I want to say about the red shoes is, do the actual red shoes themselves have to be designed, presumably?
Well, no, they're point shoes.
Are they just red point shoes?
And they're red, and we had a whole... I mean, similar, there's a scene in the film which is exactly what happened to, you know, you audition the Reds. You know, you kind of go, no, it's too orange. No, it's too purple. No, it's too... So, you know, we had several attempts at trying to get the shoes as red as we could possibly get them.
Yeah, I suppose that's what I meant, really. And they are so... I mean, it's the first thing we see.
It is. And in hindsight, I think we probably should have had them made. What we did was we bought point shoes and we dyed them. I think probably now, when we revive it, I'm going to suggest that we actually just get the right red satin and we get them made well in advance.
Can we talk about some of your other work with Matthew? And you're just doing early adventures now, but that's some of that's revived, and you were explaining to me that there's a new work in there as well. Mm-hmm. So there's been quite a lot of period stuff, hasn't there? You're having to constantly think of period, aren't you?
Yeah, I think that's important. It depends on the piece. When we did Sleeping Beauty, you know, the whole premise was if she goes to sleep for 100 years and if she wakes up now, when would 100 years ago be? Because Matt and I certainly went to one Sleeping Beauty, and I'd seen several others, and we did sit down and go, you know, in all the classical versions, you know, she kind of, we see her in World of Tutu, World of Ballet, and then she goes to sleep and she wakes up and she's still in World of Tutu, World of Ballet. And yes, if you know costume history, you might notice that something's changed a bit, but not enough to say there's been a massive change in society. And so actually working back from now to 100 years ago was great, and it just, by fluke, absolute fluke, kind of coincided to be when Tchaikovsky wrote the piece. So we could go from, you know, late 1900s right up to now.
Yeah, so those decisions are always there, having to be made, but sometimes you are rooted in period.
I think at the same time, we decide when the period is. Particularly with the dance pieces with Matt, we kind of go, when we started on Play Without Words, all we knew was we wanted to do a piece probably about a servant-master relationship, a bit like The Servant, the film. And then having done that work and looked at stuff, we kind of said, you know, this really does work in the late 50s, early 60s. That's quite good. So let's work in that. That we could have said, let's do it now. It's our choice. But once you've made that decision, it gives you parameters and it gives you rules, which make designing really easy.
So that had an incredible set. I'm just remembering the set.
It did. It had a kind of revolving staircase. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and the whole premise of that was because it was about master servant, I kind of wanted to do a staircase, a grand staircase that went up. And then on the back of it, a kind of servant staircase that came down. So it drove itself around. It wasn't on a revolve. It kind of drove itself around so that you could have a grand staircase for the front of house, as it were. But when you went into the kitchen, you had a little kind of grotty dog leg staircase that was a different kind of flavour.
Yes, well, I'm just remembering other sets of costumes to go with it. I'm thinking of Edward Scissorhands. I'm thinking of the Cinderella with the wartime setting. There's so many, but it's always a question of rooting it first, isn't it, then, I presume, of making those decisions. I mean, your Edward Scissorhands is lovely gingham world, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Edward Scissorhands was... I mean, the film is set in the 80s. It's set in the 1980s. The version we do... Because it was America, and it was kind of moving it back a bit, we set it in the 50s, really, so that you kind of got the American dream. And so the idea of the Gothic character coming into it was more of a clash. But yes, it's like I said earlier, it's about finding characters, because everything I do is narrative. It's narrative and character-based. And so once you've got the character and you know what they are, then you've got the world, or vice versa. Once you've made the world, you know who the character should be in it.
What about The Car Man then? Because that used car loss is an extraordinary thing, and that became a film, didn't it?
We did, yeah, we filmed it twice. We filmed it once in a studio and once on stage. And that was very much a kind of... it was after Cinderella, and we were kind of wanted to do something. We knew it wanted to be kind of Midwest America, and we knew it wanted to be grimy and a little bit sexy and a little bit kind of physical. And so taking it, again, late 50s, early 60s, sort of had the right feel of characters for us.
Yes, if I just say The Car Man, I can just see that garage lot, you know, with all these cars. And they make good machines for acting, don't they?
They do. And you know, Car Man was weird. It was one of those pieces that when I designed it, I kind of thought I'd not seen this before. You know, of course we've all seen cloths, we've all seen gauzes, but this was a kind of strange two-tiered metal structure that had sliders in it that couldn't be operated from the theatre. So it had its own counterweight system in it so that it was operated within it. And I remember being really, really proud of it. And I remember nobody noticing it at all. So it was a kind of double-edged sword in that you don't want people to come away whistling or singing the design. But at the same time, it was certainly in its first outing, it was so ignored. And I absolutely thought I'd done something that I'd not done before and that I'd not seen before. And I kind of was a bit surprised that no one else noticed that. But then again, it got much more attention when it came back. I think it was a much more successful revival. I think all our shows with new adventures get better because when we revive them, that, you know, we're all back again doing it. So we know what we want to improve. We know what we'd like to improve on. Whereas with the bigger companies, when they, for instance, when the Royal Opera House revived Seven Deadly Sins, you're kind of told it's happening, but you're not invited back as a designer. You are as a choreographer, but you're not as a designer. And so you're given two tickets for the first night and you turn up and you just see it.
You must want to be in on it.
You'd like to be, but if you're not invited, you can't force your way in.
No. Well, that obviously brings up, I think, something that everybody, I mean, Matthew says in the programme, doesn't he? Talks about you, the family of New Adventures, and it is, isn't it? I mean, that's the whole point. There must be wonderful reunions where we're back on. With your new adventure and your new set of problem solving, because that's what you're doing, isn't it? You're saying, right, I want this. How do we solve the problem of me getting it?
Yeah, and it is a family. It's oddly, Matt's family is very different from my family. Matt's family is very much centered around the dancers, because that's who, when he gets to that point, that's who he's working with. He's in the studio, usually Etta Murfitt or Scott Ambler, they're actually restaging it, and Matt sits back and directs the actors, and so he edits what they give him. My family are the people that Matt never really meets, like the makers, the prop makers, the costume makers, the painters, and yes, the dancers to a certain extent, but the dancers do come and go. That it's not a permanent company, so you know, different people are cast in different roles at different times. And so there's a much smaller company, which is the remains of, I mean, I joined New Adventures about 24 years ago. And the only people left from that company are Matt, Etta Murfitt, and me. You know, and I always think of myself as the new boy because I've been there 23 years, Etta's been there 25 years, Matt's been there for 30 years. And yes, it is a family, sometimes dysfunctional. It's 23 years of knowing these people and working with them and admiring them and loving them and fighting with them and bickering with them. And it's a little bit of a family. However, as a designer, whether you're working in opera or whether you're working in plays or whether you're working in even film, for me, it's because I don't do abstract dance. I don't do that. It's not, I don't understand it. I don't completely get it. But because everything, as I said earlier, is narrative and driven by character, the process for whatever you're doing is always the same. And that you can, like, for instance, when I used to, the process I went with Christopher Gable, I did 10 years with Christopher Gable, I've done 23 years with Matthew Bourne. Even though the work is very, very different, even though what ends up on stage is very different, and not necessarily Matt's taste when he sees Christopher's work or Christopher's taste when he sees Matt's work, but the process is the same, and the results are very specific to the collaboration that you're with. So the show that Christopher and I did was very particular to Christopher and me, and the show that Matt and I do are very particular to what Matt and I do. And that's the joy, actually. That's the joy that I get to flit around different directors and make different unisons and little teams and can come up with different kinds of work. Because I think it was Bill Dudley who said, you know, and I think I completely agree with this, you know, as designers, we are not fashion designers. We're not interior designers. We're people working in pastiche. We're working in somebody else's idiom. We're either making decisions on behalf of a character or a world that's not our own. So we're not doing what Dior would do. We're not designing the best dress we can. We're designing the dress that's right for that character in that situation at that time, which might mean we're designing something we don't like. So it's a brilliant and funny world, and it is even more than a director. We have to have one foot in the art camp and one foot in the practicality camp and the making it happen camp.
Yeah. That's costume. And have you got a comment on set? Because you were talking about drawing before. So, mm-hmm. You know, is there something similar that you'd like to say about set?
I think set is... The set defines more the way in which you do a production. Like, for instance, on Fiddler on the Roof, which I'm working on at the moment, I know what I don't want to do. I don't yet know what I do want to do, but I don't want to do kind of a folksy world. I don't want to do a fairy tale world. I want to do an actor-based world, a world where a group of immigrants come into a space, make it their own, and are then chased out of it. That's the basic story of Fiddler. And so what set does is it gives you, it defines the production standards, where you're going to go. And once you've decided that, once you've come up with the whole, W-H-O-L-E, world, then how you solve the things in it become easy.
Yes, and that's not a team that you work with time and again so much then?
No, not necessarily. You go to different workshops for different skills. If you want carving, you go there. If you want metalwork, you go there. That's less... It is a collaboration in how you build something, but it's less of a collaboration about where you start from.
Yes, well, I can't wait to see your Fiddler on the Roof, which I guess will be slightly less schmaltzy than usual then.
I hope so.
Thank you so much, Les Brotherston, for speaking to me for Theatre Voice. It's been incredible.
Thank you for coming.